Welcome to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast with your host Nicole Rose from the Solidarity Apothecary. This is your place for all things plants and liberation. Let's get started. Hello, welcome back to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast. This episode today is all about defendant support. So it's for people who are, you know, have some kind of case open, who are potentially facing prison or other repercussions. And how, you know, my kind of like tidbits of wisdom from doing this for a really long time of kind of, you know, different approaches to responding to repression and like benefits of solidarity, things like this. There's not that much herbal focus, but I'm going to be recording an episode all about like herbal support for kind of really long-term chronic stress soon. I just want to say, I hope you are enjoying the Herbal Support Through Repression series. Just shameless plug, the Herbalism, PTSD and Traumatic Stress course is coming back in September. And yeah, I'm going to put the link to the waiting list in the show notes. I get so many emails. I literally get like 20 emails after every course launch from people who are like, I missed it. I'm like, just get on the waiting list. And then it's just literally an email list. And it means I can keep you updated when it's open. And anyone that joins the waiting list gets like a discount code if they're a paying person. Because, you know, I've said before, it is literally no one turned away for lack of funds. Like it is possible to access the course for free if you are in financial distress. Join the waiting list. The bonus this year is a free place on the practical medicine making intensives next year, which always sell out. They're fucking amazing 3-day courses with just putting all of this stuff into practice. So yeah, anyone who joins the waiting list and then goes on to join the course will get entered into kind of like a raffle, and then yeah, the winner will get a free place on the course, which is £250 for the course and then £75 for food and accommodation. So it's like £325, fucking bargain. So anyway, please join the waiting list. And yeah, I talk about this at the end, but if anyone is going through repression and would benefit from some herbal support, please hit me up and I will get a herbal care package in the post to you. I'm so, so excited to be starting the Hawthorn program. I've got 10 folks who are in the midst of repression, who are all up getting involved and trying herbal support and having some group calls and some collective care. So yeah, I'm really excited to get that going. All right. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. And I talk about it at the beginning, but this is like an excerpt from my Herbalism and State Violence book. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. And final thing, it's fucking elderberry season. They're everywhere. It's amazing. Well, depending on where you are in the world, but where I am in Somerset in England, they're fucking everywhere. So I put this on my newsletter yesterday, but I've got a free recipe on my website, which is how we make our amazing elderberry cough syrup from glycerin, which doesn't contain any sugar, and is like safe for children and is just absolutely delicious and really effective. So please download that. And my Making Herbal Medicine with Glycerin workshop is still on sale for £30. Absolute bargain. You will be able to make medicine for the rest of your life easily, affordably, without alcohol, which is much more expensive and accessible for people in our communities. And that workshop is also no one turned away for lack of funds. So please email support@solidarityapothecary.org if you need the discount code. All right. And final plug. I put a thing in the newsletter yesterday, but I'm going to be trying to make cough syrup for the Calais project like consistently to kind of take some of the pressure off our amazing medicine making coordinator. But I'm going to need some help because I don't have much capacity at the moment because I'm still looking after my baby boy most of the time. If anyone is interested in coming to mine and making some cough syrup, just literally like stirring, adding the marshmallow glue, bottling, labeling hundreds of bottles, please email support@solidarityapothecary.org and my amazing assistant Chantel will pick up your email and get back to you about next steps. So anyway, thank you for listening. I'm sorry if the sound of this bit is bad. I'm actually recording this introduction in the car without my microphone, so it's not as good quality, but the rest of the episode is fine as I recorded it previously with my microphone. Anyway, thanks a lot and take care. Bye. This section is all about the chronic stress involved in being wrapped up in the so-called criminal justice system and how it affects people's lives and well-being. I've supported hundreds of people over the years experiencing repression, including many people preparing for stressful trials. This section looks at what support has been helpful in general before sharing a section on herbal support at the end. One of the critical weapons of the state is to create a lot of uncertainty and fear in your life. Even if you don't end up with a very long sentence in prison or any sentence in prison, having that the feeling that you might is a real mental weapon of oppression. Humans like to feel a sense of control over their life, a sense of certainty. Events are often more traumatizing when we have uncertainty. For example, people with long-term cancer diagnoses have a sense of constant unknowing and closeness to death. It's so exhausting to navigate those emotions. Repression is challenging because in our heads, we're always running the worst case scenario. I spent 2 years on bail believing I was likely getting 14 years in prison, the maximum sentence for my charge. And just a side note, the reason that felt very realistic was because three people had been given that sentence for this New Church guinea pig farm campaign. So it kind of felt like, yeah, that was like inevitable, if that makes sense. Anyway, people have different coping strategies. Some defendants I've supported are very engaged in their legal work. They might be researching case law, getting witness statements, organizing their own support campaigns. They're proactively doing things, and that gives them like a sense of control. In my experience, however, lots of people also, as a survival response, prefer to bury their head in the sand. They don't want to go to legal meetings or read their paperwork. They don't want to attend court hearings unless they absolutely have to. And this kind of like avoidance pattern can be really challenging when you're doing solidarity work. But I think there's a space in between where support can really happen, where people can grasp a sense of empowerment by working with someone else to read difficult paperwork, get witness statements, or do court preparation and cross-examination practice. There is a sense of gentle accountability of reminding someone that they have a court date coming up. Anarchists and other organizers that do anti-repression work are fantastic at this kind of legal support. Often, though, the real challenge that people are facing is the emotional onslaught and difficult decisions. How do they interact with people that they're having relationships with? Do they stay with their partners, or do they break up with them in case they go to prison? How do they talk to their families or friends? And what about their employers or co-workers? Unfortunately, defendants often feel a lot of shame and humiliation. Maybe they've made a security mistake. A dodgy hard drive has been found by a cop, for instance. Or maybe they got drunk at a protest, which meant they did things they wouldn't do when they were sober. We really noticed this with the Kill the Bill uprising in Bristol. Lots of people were very intoxicated, which meant they were laying into police and throwing things off the police station and doing it all without a mask on. People had to confront a lot of shame and embarrassment about that. Now they're facing years in prison because of something that could have been prevented just by wearing a mask. In my experiences of supporting people with repression, preparing them for prison is one of the most useful things we can do. We have a comprehensive checklist of things to pack and to take, things to prepare, like lists of contacts, copies of prescriptions, things like that. All of these small practical details can really help someone feel more in control. We also connect co-defendants with former prisoners so that they can ask questions about what prisoners really like, how they should act inside, for example, or things to avoid, like snitching on people or brown-nosing officers. All of these things can help someone feel more prepared, and that can really help reduce the levels of traumatization and also the hardcore impacts of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, I use the phrase PTSD, like, I don't prescribe to the kind of PTSD as in like pathologizing people for trauma, if that makes sense. I use it as just kind of like something that people understand and resonate with, like almost like slang, like as a common language rather than like an acceptance of like diagnostic manuals or psychiatry, for example, which is super oppressive. Anyway, that's like a whole other thing, and there's like a whole lesson in it about in the herbalism PTSD and traumatic stress course. I just use that language because lots of people like resonate with it, and that's like their gateway into like further support, if that makes sense, and more like kind of radical perspectives around their own like health and distress and trauma. Okay, anyway, where was I? I don't think that they can ever be completely avoided, like for example PTSD around prison, but solidarity can make a massive difference in reducing how exhausting, alienating and isolating that experience is. People often don't realize the effect that the chronic stress of these situations has on our bodies. Everyone has their own fault line, the ways that they express distress. Some people get really nervous tummies, for example, and their digestion just goes completely out of whack when they're under any stress or pressure. Other people will start to get really bad neck pain or muscle pain. Other people might get chronic headaches or migraines. We're all different. I think our role as herbalists is to help people draw attention to what's happening in their bodies, to help observe how they're experiencing distress and then offer support. We can support them with herbs to reduce how scary and activating being in court can be. If someone can go to court feeling calmer and less anxious, then they will feel more in control and they're more articulate on the stand, which is like the place in court where, you know, you get asked questions or you're like, quote unquote, cross-examined. How well someone, quote unquote, performs could make the difference to whether they go to prison or not. And I know that sounds dramatic, but it's like fucking true. Basically, like in terms of if a jury likes you or trusts you or believes you, right? Like, and how you like are perceived by others is like very critical. And being like less activated in that like highly sympathetic fight flight state into something more sort of calmer is like, yeah, I think that's really important. Anyway, right, vicarious trauma. High levels of stress are experienced by families, co-defendants, and other people in the courtroom. It's a very stressful situation for everyone. It's horrible. Like, it is fucking horrible. It's probably like, yeah, it's horrible witnessing people get sent to prison. It's horrible seeing this huge power imbalance, the judges, the barristers. It's horrible seeing how this whole system works and how brutally they treat people. There is like a level of vicarious trauma that people go through. In Bristol, we've just watched, you know, and this was written a few years ago. In Bristol, we've just watched as over 30 people went to prison, one after the next, and it's so emotionally exhausting. We can prepare someone the best we can and help them try and get off their charge. But ultimately, we have very little power and people are inevitably going to go to prison until the system has been completely changed or like completely fucking destroyed, right? Part of this work is accepting that this is reality and people will go down and we will watch them go down. We will watch them have their last hugs with their partners who they might not be able to touch again for ages. We see them cry and beg not to be taken down. People are extremely distressed in these situations and we have to witness that. And so do the parents, siblings, friends and partners who walk out of court like completely devastated. I remember when I was 17 and my boyfriend, this was the second boyfriend I had that had gone to prison. But yeah, my partner at the time got sent down with two other friends of mine from the Shack campaign. And yeah, I was left like completely alone. I was the only person in the courtroom supporting them. I got followed by journalists like all the way back to my car. And when they finally left me and stopped harassing me, I actually just like burst into tears and began to accept that this was really happening, you know. And I wish more than anything that I'd had a support team or a solidarity campaign that had could have just sat with me in court and held my hand as I watched this guy that I was in love with go to prison. And, you know, he was never the same after his experiences inside some of the most violent young offenders institutions in the country. Okay, the effects of uncertainty. I've mentioned uncertainty as one factor that makes this all so stressful on the body. Bail conditions are another part of this. So these are conditions imposed by the court that someone has to like, quote unquote, comply with. If they don't comply with them, then they face the threat of imprisonment and the withdrawal of that kind of bail. So in my case, like we had a long list of people we weren't allowed to talk to. We'd have to get permission to stay away from home. We weren't allowed to publish anything on the internet or to write articles. There was basically like this complete gagging order about the case and we had to like surrender our passports and stuff. And, you know, it's not the same as a cop beating you up, but actually it is such a pervasive control of every moment of our life. Like, can I go to this cafe or will I bump into someone I'm not allowed to talk to? Will I go to prison for having a coffee with someone in the wrong place? Like, should I just sack off a bail condition and write an article anonymously? But is it worth the risk? And, you know, and it can be okay for a short amount of time, but I was waiting for over 2 years before I went to prison. And my co-defendants who didn't plead guilty, like initially they were waiting for nearly 4 years. That's like half a decade of their life, you know, experiencing oppression, controls, uncertainty of whether they're going to prison, how long they would get. You know, the court dates kept getting pushed back over and over again. And like I took the initiative to plead guilty because I was like, sick of living under this control and I knew that I was going to get a custodial sentence. You know, I had legal advice that it would be better to just crack on with my sentence. And yeah, like it's a story for around the fucking campfire with comrades, all right? I'm not going to go into the reasons of that decision other than, you know, trying to show up for people. But yeah, for me, I was like completely fucked basically with some stuff that came up against me, and it was just clear that I was going to get found guilty. Like everyone had been found guilty before me, and our like batch of people in the second trial, in a way would serve them if I was like singled out as the person doing all the animal liberation front stuff. So anyway, I pled guilty. Because of that decision to just crack on with my sentence, which I don't regret, like I was out basically nearly before everyone, like several years before other people had even started their sentences. So I could kind of move on with my life. With these long timescales and vast amounts of uncertainty, people aren't able to plan like the most basic things in their life, like should they get a tenancy on this new flat, or are they going to go to court, should they apply for this job, go to uni, take a course, should they start a new relationship. You know, prison is just like constantly hanging over people's heads. The impacts of remand. So many people are like instantly remanded the second they get arrested, well, you know, after the first day in the police station. Nearly 1 in 7 people are on remand in prisons in England and Wales. And being on remand basically means like you don't know your sentence. So some people are convicted, so like they've already pled guilty, but many people like haven't and are like awaiting trial. Just like a sad note, the rate of like self-inflicted deaths of remand prisoners has like consistently been around 3 times higher than that of convicted prisoners. And I think this comes back to this like common trauma dynamic that I talk in the PTSD course of like uncertainty is like one of the most difficult things for humans. I did 19 months in prison, like on remand, before I even knew like how long I would be there for. There's just like there's a lot of like impacts of that on people's like mental health and like emotional health. Just in terms of the politics of remand, like the process is like massively racialized and classed. So if you can't prove that you've got like a fixed abode, then you're much more likely to get remanded. So that's obviously like super targeting people in precarious housing or people who are unhoused. If you've got like previous convictions, you're much more likely to get remanded. And if you're like a person of color, then you're way more likely to get remanded. So some stats here, I don't know when they're from, but it's in the footnote of the book. So black men are 26% and men with a quote unquote mixed ethnic background in their language are 22% more likely to be remanded in custody at the Crown Court than white men. So when you're on remand, you have to deal with constant uncertainty, but you're also in prison, right? So you don't know when you're going to get out. You don't have good communication with your solicitor. You have limited phone credit, limited legal visits. And it all means that you're not like adequately resourced to prepare for your trial, if you even get, you know, a trial. Remand is like a super, you know, big weapon of repression. On a side note of obviously this was... before this happened, but if you look at the Filton 23, who are now used to be Filton 18, and then people have been remanded the last few days, like a lot of the people like organizing for Palestine have been getting found like not guilty in court, right? Like not obviously all of them, I'm talking about English context here. But I think the state really knows that given like what is happening in Gaza and like the public opinion. Actually, to keep people like on remand waiting for their trials is like really fucking clever, like classic state tactic, you know. And I think the British state just has mastered the art of statecraft like more than any other state in the world, in my opinion. In terms of, you know, oh my god, this is such a side rant, but in terms of like this kind of like facade of like liberal democracy, I think remanding people does like then create a more like climate of fear in movements, because people are frightened if they do an action, like that's it, they're just gonna instantly be remanded. Especially if people aren't likely to be convicted, then it's just a really effective way of like traumatizing people and keeping them out of action. So what can we do? Advice for defendants and the importance of support and solidarity. So my advice to people who are going through any of this is to remember that like we're all different and that we all benefit from different coping strategies. So for myself, like I know I have a tendency to be like hyper responsible, over controlling, and like a planner. Like planning is so soothing to me. That's just not for everyone. I've got like 4 planets in Capricorn, by the way, like moon in Capricorn. So it's just like, give me a fucking concept plan or like folders, and I'm like happy as Larry. But that's really not everyone's style, right? And I do think, like I said, like we see better results in court when people are more prepared. And part of state intimidation is making us feel like this isn't the place for us, right? So, which it fucking isn't, of course. Like, it's absolutely the zone of solicitors and barristers and the upper classes. Yet, we can still do our best to fight despite all the inequalities, the massive cuts to legal aid, poor legal support, literacy issues, and all of those challenges. And yeah, like, I think I'd like to just, like, I don't know if he listens to this show, probably doesn't, but like, one of my exes like had a lot more experience in like court support. Like I've always been like heavily doing prisoner support and, you know, lots of anti-repression work, but I was always very like combative with solicitors and just like, it's not that I didn't see the point of doing loads of legal work, but I just like, I'd never seen it like materialize into any sort of justice, like quote unquote justice. I hate that phrase, but like he really influenced me of like how tactically, if someone can like utilize their privilege to help someone with that legal work, that actually it is often full of fucking holes, and it is possible to get witness statements or CCTV or footage to like counter things that the state have presented. And I think it just gave me like a little bit more belief that it is possible to put up a good fucking fight in court, because he'd come from a background more where there was like more like accountable kind of actions, you know, people doing lock-ons and like, you know, going to court, and it was like all a bit of a spectacle. And like for me, this isn't in the book, right, this is like a side note, like for me, I'd grown up in this like hyper militant, mostly underground to be honest, animal liberation movement where like you would never fucking like show your face on camera, like everything was anonymous, like you just did the shit and tried to get away with it, right? And you know, you wouldn't, like the courts were never used as like a battleground. Like maybe like some groups would use that strategy, but generally it was just like keep your fucking self out of prison as much as possible. So like when I got out of prison and just sort of like I was doing this like anti-fracking campaign, and I just kind of like started to meet more kind of like middle class, I guess, like environmental campaigners. And it was like fascinating to me that they would just like voluntarily get arrested for something of kind of like civil disobedience, like resistance stuff. And I was just like, what the fuck is this? However, I can also see how it is like more accessible for lots of people and yeah, like all sorts of factors. But I just want to say that like, I think it is worth putting up a good fucking fight in court to keep people free. I think it's worth doing fucking anything to keep someone out of prison. And yeah, I'm not going to criminalize myself by sharing more than that. You can probably imagine what I'm going to say, but I just mean like, yeah, I think it is worth putting up a fight for the sake of keeping someone out of that fucking dungeon. Anyway, back to what I've written here. So yeah, I'm talking about how, you know, courts aren't our fucking spaces. Okay, so if there's access to people that have confidence and experience in supporting people with legal cases, take every offer of help you can get. Embrace your legal nerd friends who like that stuff. Maybe you have a cousin who just gone out with someone who went to law school or something. Just pull in all the support you can. Even better if it's someone with experience and who understands the reality of inequalities. But just, you know, get as much advice as you can. Be as proactive as you possibly can. Like I would repeatedly plan scenarios of, okay, if I get 10 years, this is what I'm going to do. If I get 5 years, this is what I'm going to do. If I get a suspended sentence, this is what I'm going to do. This is where I'm going to live. And I think that kind of like scenario planning, like can give you a sense of control. Even though you're not in control, but I just mean to like counteract this trauma effect of uncertainty. Okay, talk to former prisoners. So like in some ways it can be really scary to hear the stories. But in other ways it's also kind of like good to like combat some of the myths. And you know, we get a lot of like cultural baggage around prisons, right? From TV shows and films that just aren't real. Or maybe, you know, there's some reality, but it's not quite as bad as we imagine. And you know, like we never, and also like side note, it can be as fucking bad as that or worse, but I just, yeah, like we don't actually talk about like the quote unquote good stuff, right, of prison. Like, for example, when I was in prison, I made some amazing friendships and there was all this like support and care and love from all these beautiful women and femmes. And it was like a really like queer environment. And like, yeah, I kind of really enjoyed that aspect of it, if that makes sense. Anyway, Okay, talking to someone who's been inside will help you prevent yourself from filling in the blanks of stuff that you don't know. So everything from whether it's possible to get razors, to shave your legs, to how often officers force sex on prisoners and will they get raped. Getting perspectives from someone who's been in prison who can tell you their truth is really, really helpful. Likewise, I think reading books about prison, autobiographies and so on can be useful. When I was inside, I was reading like Assata Shakur and Nelson Mandela, you know, like, and it can really help you feel connected to other people's experience of prison and repression. Okay, so there's an important question about how public to be with support. Like, there are lots of opinions from doing things totally privately, all the way up to like really big public campaigns. And there are like different perspectives about what's best in terms of tactics. Like, I am not going to judge people's approaches, but I will name here that, like, I think from my perspective, I like solidarity is power. I haven't seen people be harmed by having connections to groups and movements, though there are obviously those risks. You know, and that's a lie. Like, I have seen people be harmed in the sense of, you know, they've been convicted of blackmail or something because of their relationship to a movement. But I have seen so many fucking people be harmed because they've been isolated from support networks. You know, because they've like self-withdrawn as a trauma response, like, or just, you know, like maybe they're not like on trial for something political, but they just, you know, have been dropped out by their like family and stuff and like don't have that like support network. But yeah, I have seen people who have tried to like, you know, and this again, this isn't in the book, but, you know, have tried as a tactic of self-preservation to not be associated with other people, and it is just like backfired in their fucking face, and then they've ended up in prison. You know, sometimes people change their minds and then end up getting listed. Like, this fucking happened loads in the animal liberation movement. Like, people would just come off all the lists and say they don't want public contact, and you just be like, what the fuck, like, have they snitched on someone, like, what's happened? And then all of a sudden, like, they, you know, they're listed again, and then they're not, and like, yeah, like, I, you know, or they want to appeal, so then they come off all the lists and distance themselves, and it's like, I don't know, I'm not into that sort of fuckery. Like, but I was like very hardline when I was a kid, in the sense of like the judge in my case just like told me like I showed no remorse, and he was just like, he also called me super intelligent, you know, it gave me like proper fucking dad vibes, you know, because I didn't grow up with my dad, so I was just like, yeah, daddy tells me I'm clever. Anyway, oh my God, I'll need to edit that out. Right, anyway, but what I'm saying is, like, I didn't, like, submit any fucking paperwork, like, of mitigation, of, like, oh, hey, I'm a nice person, this is my, like, private school head teacher writing a statement or something. Like, I didn't have any of that shit. Like, I really was just, like, a fucking teenager, basically. But I didn't want to, like, participate in that court process, so I just kind of, like, not boycotted it, because I still had to go to court because I was in prison, but I mean, like, I didn't play the game of like all the things. And then, like I've said, like over the years, I've seen, like, I've had to eat my fucking words, basically, of friends being dragged through cases. And if they had followed my advice at the time and just been more militant, they would have just been fucked and had like several more years in prison. But instead, you know, they got all the statements from their middle class mates to like write these like positive things about them and pitched all this stuff as like voluntary work and blah blah blah, and like just kind of played the privilege card, I guess, and they were rewarded for that. And I still don't know how I feel about that, but they did less time in prison, which is fucking important. So anyway, this is a long side rant, but I'm just trying to encourage that. I think being connected to like powerful public support campaigns where you're like politicizing your case and you're getting support from people, like letters and fundraising and stuff, like, I think that stuff's like really powerful and beautiful and necessary. So that's all I'm trying to say. So there are different ways of running a public support campaign. You know, there might be demonstrations outside court, courtrooms full of people supporting them, people writing political statements and talking to the media. In my experience, those defendants get through their experiences in a much more empowered way, you know, with all the consequences that has for their nervous systems, because they feel more in control. And, you know, I know it takes a lot of courage to take a political position, which might mean getting a longer time in prison. You know, for example, you know, there have been like countless times in history where people have actually taken a stance and been rewarded for it. But of course, you know, the absolute opposite is true and every single case is different. But yeah, I just mean like, again, this is a side note, but just like our nervous systems really thrive when like we aren't just being led by uncertainty, but like we're leading with kind of agency. And I think like when people take the initiative with their cases, like to the best they can, like they do have like less kind of sympathetic, like stress response. Does that make sense? Anyway, okay. So the J20 is a recent example of where defendants massively organized with each other. So they had support campaigns all over the so-called US, including people who were arrested during the Trump inauguration. And they came from all different walks of life, right? Journalists, mothers, bystanders, photographers, anarchists, Black Bloc. And they got thrown in together as defendants and they were facing life sentences in prison. But they were so consistent with their political organizing, with huge support campaigns, fundraising, massive legal meetings, making decisions by consensus and so on, that they got to a place where they decided it was an option not to not cooperate, and they took non-cooperating plea deals. And they couldn't be prosecuted and the charges were eventually dropped, which saved like 60 odd people from going to prison for life. And yeah, there are lots of other examples of from history of successful politically organized defense campaigns. Oh, and one of my favorite books on this subject is called Defiance. I'll try and find a link to where you can get it and put it in the show notes, but it's a list of like anarchist speeches from people who were sent to prison like throughout history. And it goes back like hundreds of years. Oh, excuse me. And it's really inspiring. Like some people were even taken, like were even at the gallows, for example, but they like refused to back down. And yeah, taking inspiration from other political organizers who have gone through the same things or similar things is like really important. And other recommendations are like the general basic things around taking care of yourself, like things like getting enough sleep, having social support, having friends that you can talk to and who can listen to you and make you feel supported. You know, this is the time when you need to prioritize your relationships because the state will intentionally try to destroy them through fear, uncertainty and political divisions and groups. They will try every dirty tactic in the book to keep you alone and isolated. And our best resistance, I think, is developing relationships and sustaining them the best you can. For me, I did the whole thing completely alienated. You know, I was separated from people. There was no support campaign. Like, you know, when my ex and I went to court, it would cost us 30 quid on travel, which was like 80% of the weekly benefit gone. And yeah, you just have to shoplift the rest of the week just to feed yourself. So yeah, I guess I can sometimes feel a bit jealous of defendants that have good support networks. And yeah, just, I guess a side note is like, it's really fucking hard when you don't have support. And obviously most people going through the prison system don't have any fucking support at all. And it is worth naming that like political organizers are like a rare minority somehow. But if it is there, then like, yeah, tapping into it is really important. Okay, I've written here, starting a new hobby, knitting, drawing, whatever you like, can be really distracting and enriching. I know loads of defendants who have got really into tattooing, for example. They taught themselves how to draw in prison and are now tattoo artists. Being really engaged in an activity can support you to access that like parasympathetic nervous system state, which is really a powerful tool when the state is trying to create constant fear and anxiety in you. Thanks so much for listening to the Frontline Herbalism podcast. You can find the transcript, the links, all the resources from the show at solidarityapothecary.org/podcast.